All this is leading us in the general direction of the events of Easter, but we're not there yet. You know, before we come to where we are in the story, should we quickly do a recap? Some of you are looking concerned this is going to take a long time. I'll be as quick as I can. But should we jump back to the beginning? And when I say jump back to the beginning, let's jump back roughly 13.7 billion years ago to the beginning of the universe. And we'll go from there year by year. So bear with me. But no, but roughly now, the general consensus is, some people have disputed it recently, the universe may be even older. But around 13.7 billion years ago, something happened to spark an event that's colloquially, if that's a word, known as the Big Bang, and the universe was breathed into existence. It's awesome. This is an image, one of the first images that, in fact, the first image that came back from the James Webb Telescope that's been sending back images for a couple of years now, blowing the socks off astronomers and those who enjoy seeing this stuff. And just give you a sense of the scale we're talking about when I talk about the universe came into being. Ignore the bright, shiny kind of things at the front of that image, which are stars. But do you see those slightly blurry lights throughout there? But those aren't stars. Those are galaxies. And we now think there are at least 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Can you even picture 100 billion of anything? And each of those galaxies has roughly 100 billion stars within it. I mean, so 100 billion times 100 billion means that the universe is big. I mean, it's awesome. It's beyond our comprehension. I mean, I thought that the work's going on this weekend at the M25 were on a big scale. But I mean, the universe blows the socks off this. I mean, we're part of something so much bigger than ourselves. We are such a tiny part of something so ginormous it's beyond our ability to grapple with. And yet part of the miracle of human existence is that we have the capacity to our greatest minds can wrestle with this stuff and draw sense and meaning from this ever-expanding cosmos. Wow, it's amazing we're here at all. Gosh, it's incredible. Now, the Bible tells a story, and it's not a scientific account of how the universe came into being, but it's a story that runs parallel. And it talks rather about the technical details about galaxies and stars and great balls of gas in the sky. It talks about there being a coherent mind beyond this awesome universe, and that mind isn't something abstract and weird that has nothing to do with us, but it's a mind that made this universe for a purpose, and that part of the purpose, if you zoom in on one galaxy called the Milky Way, and you zoom in on one solar system, a strange star called the Sun, and you zoom in on the third planet of that solar system, there are creatures that evolved called human beings, and somehow these human beings are part of a bigger story, and that mind beyond this huge cosmos, that mind made us and wants to have a relationship with us and will not give up on us, because we are somehow, in some way it's impossible to fully comprehend, made in the image of that mind with the ability to comprehend and explore and create. So the story the Bible tells in all sorts of different ways through different forms of literature is that we were made with a purpose. And the first week of when we looked at Covenant, we said that we are made, and unlike all the ancient stories told in the ancient world, we are made not as extra slave labor for the gods, but we're made to have a relationship with God. We're made not because we were needed, but because we are wanted. We are not a cosmic accident. We are a creature that the creator of the cosmos delights in and wants to get to know. You are made with a purpose to do your work and to do the relationships that you have with creativity and enthusiasm and wonder and joy. You are a miracle of existence, and God wants to have a relationship with you. But the history of humanity is that we have often chosen to live very differently to the way our God's created us to. And the story that's told in the Bible is that of a beautiful garden where we lived as we were meant to, walking with the Creator. And yet we choose to go our own way and things go from bad to worse. And so a flood wipes out everything there is, except that God will not give up on us or creation. So after the flood, with those he saved, both creatures, the animals, and humankind, he makes a covenant that he will not wipe us out again. He will not give up on this pale blue dot floating in space that's beyond our wildest comprehension. But then God's plan is bigger, so he calls out one family, a man called Abraham, and he says to him, your descendants will be like the stars in the sky that you can see, and that through you and through them, I'm going to make it so every human being that comes to walk on earth will have the opportunity to be blessed and to encounter me, so they can have the relationship with me that they heard about in that story in the garden when they once walked with me in creative relationship and wonder and hope. And so God's then speaks to Abraham's descendants. And while they are a great people, they're in slavery in Egypt, so God calls Moses to lead them out. And we looked at that last week, and now finally, Abraham's descendants are a people operating in the world. Now we have, finally, God doing something about this covenant. So God's made a covenant, we saw last week, with this people. And that covenant involved a promise that God would be faithful according to his character to them. But it also called them to live a certain way. So he gave them the law. And this law was partly a moral law. So they had to do the things that we know are good. So don't murder people. That's normally a bad thing to do on a rainy Thursday afternoon, even when the rugby is going badly, or whatever else it may be. But also, more significantly, the Old Testament law is about being distinctive. So if you've ever read through the Old Testament law going, this is weird, you're right, because it's meant to be weird, because it was all about a people knowing that they had a distinctive role in the world. They were to be different from the nations around them as they walked with this God who created the 100 billion galaxies, each filled with 100 billion stars. So now there's this people that are meant to offer hope to the world. They're called the Israelites, and they've become a nation, and they're in this land, and they're meant to be a holy, distinctive people, so that all people on earth may see them and be drawn to the way they're living with God at their center. But there's a bit of a problem, because this vision that this people are living with God as their light guiding them begins to go wrong almost immediately. And while God never gives up on them, they constantly want to do what Adam and Eve did in the garden, which is define what's good and evil for themselves. And they increasingly want to be like the nations around them. And one of the ways they want to be like the nations around them is, whereas they're meant to be a distinctive people, who, unlike every other nation, they don't have a king, because God himself is their king, his presence in their midst, represented by the tabernacle, this place of meeting, this temple where God's presence is with them. But they begin to say, nah, we don't like that. That's a bit abstract for us. We'd like something a bit more concrete. And we notice those nice, friendly people over there, and that people over there, they have these really impressive things called kings. And they're big, tall fellows with physiques like Tim the Vicar. And they're really impressive and imposing. Why are you laughing, Jez? I'll chat to you afterwards, mate. Anyway, so we don't want this theoretical nonsense about God being in our midst. We want something concrete that we can latch onto. We'd rather replace this abstract idea with having a king, an actual king, in our midst. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 9, the people go to Samuel the prophet and say, we want a king. So Samuel goes to God, and God says, if they want a king, they can have a king. But tell them what it will mean. It will mean they'll be like the nations around them, that the king will demand of them their sons and daughters to work the land. He'll take the stuff they produce and make it their own. They'll impose taxes and oppression in all sorts of ways. So Samuel goes and says this to the people, do you really want to replace God, your king, with a human king? And the people say, yes, And then they say why. They say explicitly, because we want to be like the nations around us. We don't want to be distinctive. We don't want to be different. We want to blend into the culture that's around us. We want to conform. We want to give into the zeitgeist of our own age and be just like other people. For those of you who have been Christians for a number of years, have you ever wanted to be not like a weird Christian who gives up their Sunday morning not to go and do sports or go for a nice run or a walk, but to join other very strange people in a cold building on a rainy Sunday morning? Why do we do it? Why are we distinctive? What are we doing here? Well, that's a question for another time. It's good we do it, by the way. But there is a cost to it because it's being distinctive. So anyway, so the people get the king they wanted. And the king they wanted was this guy called Saul, who was tall and strapping and everything they wanted a king to be. And at first, it all goes well. He leads the people into battle and he defeats the enemies. And they're all very happy with Saul. But Saul very quickly stops being a king who focuses on the God who's put him on the throne and begins to focus on being more and more like the nations around them, the other kings. You know, he looks at the Joneses, kings next door, and goes, I'm going to be more like that one or that one. And they all worship other gods and they all do this and that. So the people go from bad to worse. But after a while, God does something strange. And he says to Samuel, I'm going to raise up a new kind of king, because Saul has been the sort of king the people thought they wanted. In fact, they got the king they deserved, but not the king they needed. And so he calls the most unlikely of people, a young boy called David. And you'll all know this story from Sunday school or popular culture, of this shepherd boy who slayed Goliath and became something. And he goes on all these adventures and journeys. And eventually, through these remarkable circumstances, that this boy who, unlike Saul, is a boy who's called a man after God's own heart. Doesn't mean he's going to be perfect, we'll come on to that. But it does mean that he catches a glimpse of what God's people are meant to be. A people who are distinctive with God in their midst. A people who are set apart to offer hope to a world desperately in need of hope. A people who are going to live in light though everyone else may walk in darkness and hatred. A people who are distinctive. And so David grows up and various things happen and Saul tries to kill him again and again, but eventually through a series of dramatic events, and it's a brilliant read comparable to any other story from ancient literature. It's edge of your seat, gripping stuff. It would make a great bingeable box set. David eventually comes onto the throne and he is a good king. And in fact, at the height of his power, it seems that he could do no wrong. He goes from strength to strength. And then the prophet Nathan, who's a person who communicates with God on David's behalf, has this amazing encounter with God, where God says to him to speak to David and to say these words. And this was our reading earlier. There was a lot there. I don't expect you to have taken it all in. I don't think I have. But there's this key climax to it, where God says to David through Nathan, your house and your kingdom will endure for a few weeks. No, it doesn't say that. Keep up. Will endure forever. It will be an everlasting kingdom before me, God says. Your throne will be established forever. There won't be a time in history, God says, when your descendant isn't the king of the people I'm calling to be my own. What an awesome promise for little shepherd boy David to have. But there's a problem with this promise, which is while David begins so well, like so many of us, as he goes through life, he makes some fairly horrendous mistakes. And in fact, some utterly tragic, stupid, heartbreaking, anger-induces, lack of justice, some awful decisions involving adultery and murder and hatred and, oh, David, what were you doing? And so the good throne and the good king becomes sullied and distorted. And after David passes on, his son Solomon is a good king sometimes, but things go from bad to worse, and then the kings who come afterwards are but a mere shadow of what's gone before. And so this promise that God would have an everlasting throne where David's descendants will sit on the land seems to come to an end when finally God's people are taken into exile and the final kings are taken away into captivity. And that seems to be the end of the story. God's people never forgot that God had promised that there would be a king always sitting on the throne. And so as the centuries went by and they were in exile and then returned to the land, they were waiting for the one to come who was called the Messiah or the Christ. The first is Hebrew, the second Greek, but they mean the same thing. God's anointed one who was going to be the long-awaited king to sit on the throne. And they began to picture someone who looked less like David and more like Saul. Someone who was mighty and strong and had big muscles and would lead them in battle, who would make them a nation again, just like the other nations and empires around them. The kind of king, you know, you could really put on a stamp. That kind of king. But then, about 2,000 years ago, just as this promise seemed like it had died off completely, something so unexpected and remarkable happened. That this idea of a promise, a covenant that God made with the king, David, king of God's holy people, something so unexpected, such an unexpected turn of events unfolds that no one could have seen it coming, except there were hints in prophecies. There were hints that God was going to do something unexpected, but no one guessed quite how radical it was going to be. Because someone came, and in their words and their actions, they came claiming the throne of David. And through their earthly father's line, they were indeed a descendant of King David. And they came and they acted like they owned not just the kingdom of Israel, but in fact, they had authority over the elements. They had authority over the cosmos. They had authority over all spiritual forces and power, over life and death itself. And this person was enthroned as king, not in a lovely ceremony where he was put on a big throne and they played Zadok the priest and it was all marvellous and very stirring, but in a moment of abject humiliation and defeat, whereby Jesus Christ was hung on a cross, where he was with a sign above his head saying, King of the Jews, and a crown of thorns forced upon his head. And yet, we heard in our reading in Acts, very soon after these shocking and tragic and unexpected events, people began to make this outrageous claim. People who, by the way, were willing to lay down their lives for what they claimed to have seen, that they had seen this Jesus alive again, acting as if he were king, not just of Israel, but of the whole world. That he seemed to be somehow living with them. And he seemed to be claiming kingship, not just of a people, but of the universe, with authority and power over not just a people and a land, but over life and death itself. I can't tell you what a crazy claim this is. And yet 2,000 years later, here we are, gathered in a church, in the far-flung reaches of the Roman Empire, in a church that's dedicated to a king who was enthroned in humiliation upon a cross, claiming his kingship over my life and your life. A king who said his kingdom would have no ends, that his throne would last on into eternity. And so however dark things got in the world, he would always be there with us in the darkest of times, so we could know that one day he would return to take up his throne in full, so that there would finally be justice and hope, an end to ecological ruin and fear. And in the meantime, those who are willing to call him their king, that's you and me if you choose to accept that mission, those who live in Christ's kingdom, would go about living as if the values that he proclaimed in his kingdom, that the vulnerable are loved, that the most hated and despised by society matter, that all your creativity and your goodness and your ability and your work is to be done for the good of humanity and for the glory of God, that you are eternally and radically loved by the God of the cosmos. We're to live like Jesus is our king. And bit by bit over the last 2,000 years, the values of the world, which came about as humanity walked away from God, have been so radically distorted by this vision of a king crucified that our understanding of what it means to be human has not been the same since. Jesus is Lord. He is king, the king that David could never be. God's covenant with David came to be fulfilled in the most unexpected, glorious, wonderful, beautiful ways so that we can be, however flawed we are, a glimpse of Israel as they were meant to be, a people living with God as their king and the values of God at the heart of their being. We are the people of God. But Jesus isn't just our king. He's king over the world, and he's king over 100 billion stars in the Milky Way and 100 billion galaxies into the far-flung reaches of space. For he is somehow, in some incomprehensible way, that same mind that spoke 13.7 billion years ago all of this into being. I think the evidence for that is shockingly plausible. I think the implications of that are world-shattering. And I think the hope we have and the calling we have is the hope of the world and the universe. So church, live it out. Live it out. Because if this is true, gosh, Westcott and the world will never be the same again if we grasp this and live it to the full. Should we hold a moment's quiet as the bell rings to remind us that there's been worship on this place for hundreds of years, to remind us we're part of something bigger, and to ask God what he's calling us to do this day in our workplaces, our homes, our communities, with the authority we've been given to make Jesus's kingdom more tangible to those who need the hope and the love and the peace that he offers.